Good afternoon. My name is Oriol Farrés. I am a professor at the Autonomous University of Barcelona. This is the International Symposium, John Rawls, Centenary of John Rawls, and 50th Anniversary of Theory of Justice, held in Girona in October 2021. And the organizers are the Càtedra Ferrater Mora, Universitat de Girona, Universitat Pompeu Fabra, Barcelona, Universitat Autònoma de Barcelona and Universitat de Barcelona. We are right now at the panel 11, which is online, and we have with us Tira Leni from McMaster University, and the presentation is entitled Rawlsian Anti-Capitalist Environmental Justice. There will be the presentation of Joseph Porter and Adam Gibbons. They are at the UNC Chapel Hill Rutgers University. And the title of the presentation is Existential Risk and Equal Political Liberty. And finally, Giulio Fornaroli at the UNAM, Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, and the title of his presentation is Was Political Liberalism Necessary After All? On the Irrelevance of Public Reason to Political Legitimacy. So that's it. Thank you very much for your presentations. And Tira, please go ahead.
Perfect, thank you so much. So I'm gonna share my screen for my PowerPoint. Awesome, you guys can see that all right? Okay, great. So my name is Tira Leni. I'm a second year doctoral student at McMaster University. And today I'm giving a very condensed version of my paper, which is entitled Rawlsian Anti-Capitalist Environmental Justice. So I'm gonna begin this presentation with a brief account of the focus of this paper. So in the first edition of A Theory of Justice, Rawls concedes that justice as fairness is not a complete contract theory, as it fails to embrace all moral relationships, since it would seem to include only our relations with other persons and to leave out of account how we are to conduct ourselves towards animals and the rest of nature. So although Rawls acknowledges that these questions are definitely important, he leaves them aside and recognizes the limits of his theory when it comes to this subject. My paper aims to examine this claim and conclude that the idea of a Rawlsian well-ordered society without concern for the rest of nature is a mere contradiction. Once we see how central these concerns are to the well-ordered society's success, it becomes apparent that care for the rest of nature is connected to the Rawlsian principles of justice. The properly well-ordered society then must be committed to anti-capitalist environmental justice. So this presentation is going to have 7 parts. First, I briefly describe how the well-ordered society will struggle to materialize in the first place without the concern I just outlined. Second, I try to remedy this worry through a more charitable reading of Rawls. Third, I argue that David Schweikart's system, economic democracy, provides a strong starting point for the type of solution I propose. Fourth, I describe how economic democracy must be paired with several ecological reforms. Fifth, I make some brief remarks on how the Rawlsian commitment to public education fits into this picture and generates solidarity. Sixth, I retrace the Rawlsian picture I have drawn. And finally, I make some brief concluding remarks about what this all means for the Rawlsian framework. And if you have any questions, you can ask me during the collective Q&A. So one of the guiding questions of my paper is, can the Rawlsian well-ordered society without care for the rest of nature avoid climate crisis without this built-in concern? In this first part of the presentation, the strict interpretation of Rawls's assertion that justice as fairness cannot be extended to account for the rest of nature will be taken to its extreme. So in the context of this presentation, a Rawlsian well-ordered society without care for the rest of nature does not specifically direct its citizens, institutions, or government on this topic through the principles of justice. There may be some level of environmental regulation and legislation. However, ecological concerns do not carry much importance in organizing and regulating the well-ordered society. Instead, concerns about fairness between humans are of utmost importance and rule out considerations about the rest of nature. Such an approach, it separates matters of human justice from environmental and animal justice, only dealing with the former. The following sections will show how this sort of separation is incorrect and artificial. A failure to deal with environmental and animal justice impacts elements of human justice. The two sides of justice are tied up in a way that is not acknowledged by the strict reading of Rawls. Oh, sorry, I need to go back. So first of all, social and economic inequalities. Justice of fairness as fairness is made up of two principles. The first states that all persons must possess an equal right to the most extensive basic liberties compatible with similar liberties for others. The second principle requires social and economic inequalities to be attached to offices and positions open to everyone in a way that respects fair equality of opportunity, and two, arranged in a way that benefits all, including the least advantaged, in the best way possible. The latter part of this second principle, the difference principle, is relevant here, since climate crisis often further exacerbates existing inequalities in a disproportionate way, rather than distributing burdens fairly. Natural disasters are these uncontrollable forces, and they impose financial and social burdens that are felt more by the least advantaged people and communities. Individuals who are at greater risk of being exposed to climate hazards in the first place also lack the support and resources to quickly cope and recover during the aftermath. Of course, a well-ordered society is designed to advance its members' goods and is regulated by a stable and public conception of justice. So it will initially balance out the imposition of burdens on the citizenry. But there's only so much that can be done to correct for these sorts of arbitrary or natural disadvantages. Importantly, without a proper account of how to regulate climate crisis, these arbitrary disadvantages will be more common and increasingly difficult to control. The well-ordered society then, without care for the rest of nature, will be far less likely to satisfy the difference principle over time and fall short of its own standards in this first way. Two, scarcity of resources and self-respect. Rawls describes self-respect as one of the most important primary goods. Self-respect includes two parts. First, a person must value themselves and consider their respective conception of the good and life plan as worth carrying out. Second, a person must also believe that they can actually exercise their powers and fulfill their intentions. Climate crisis diminishes self-respect by aggravating existing inequalities, as described above, and by worsening the scarcity of resources. Since the Rawlsian picture considers the well-ordered society to be this cooperative venture for mutual advantage, human cooperation under these conditions is possible and necessary. Individuals must cooperate to best suit their identity of interests, despite their conflict of interests. In the circumstances of justice, there is this moderate scarcity of resources that persons can overcome. This scarcity, however, is intensified by climate change. The climate crisis causes heightened housing insecurity, destruction of property, food insecurity, and depletes essential natural resources. The more climate change supports the worsening of the scarcity of resources, the more likely that the conditions of the well-ordered society without care for the rest of nature will be so harsh that fruitful ventures must inevitably break down. Scarcity of resources, in turn, diminishes cooperation and self-respect. When individuals and communities must worry about their basic needs, there's less time to focus on fostering fellow feeling and self-respect. Instead, persons must compete with each other to acquire basic goods. In the second way, a heightened scarcity of resources pushes on the cooperative endeavor that individuals in the well-ordered society pursue. So then there's this greater risk of cooperation breaking down, which leads to diminished self-respect and solidarity. Finally, stability. The improper distribution of inequalities and the degradation of self-respect, in turn, negatively impact the stability of the basic structure as a whole. It seems clear that a theory without ingrained care for the rest of nature might encourage ecological disaster and not yield stability. Conception of justice is more stable than another if the sense of justice that it tends to generate is stronger and more likely to override disruptive inclinations, and if the institutions it allows foster weaker impulses and temptations to act unjustly. The basic structure itself is both the site of and the victim of these problems regarding stability. The way we organize our social, political, economic, and legal systems has serious power when it comes to our treatment of the rest of nature. When the structuring does not take the rest of nature into consideration, unstable conditions negatively affect the basic structure. So then, Rawlsian institutional design projects must take these concerns into account. So the previous interpretation of Rawls's remarks on fitting the rest of nature in struggles to create just conditions due to a certain ecological oversight. There is a more charitable and nuanced approach that we can take, though. The Rawlsian framework can guarantee the success of the well-ordered society facing a climate crisis through a commitment to anti-capitalist environmental justice. So I'll argue that this care for the rest of nature can be injected into the well-ordered society by way of the political economy, several ecological reforms, and the institution of public education. So my approach to fitting in these concerns into the Rawlsian framework heavily relies on an anti-capitalist economic restructuring. So in the context of this presentation, a society is capitalist if it meets three conditions. First, the means of production are, for the most part, privately owned. Second, goods are exchanged in a market at prices that are determined by competition and demand. And finally, most people who engage in wage labor are not the owners of the means of production. So when we examine some of the ways a capitalist society generates inequalities, it quickly becomes apparent why part of the solution to fitting in environmental justice is a commitment to anti-capitalism. First, capitalism generates these staggering inequalities. It creates a distribution of wealth that erodes self-respect and solidarity. Wage laborers in a capitalist system are undervalued, underpaid, and overworked, leaving them with degraded self-respect. Next, respecting the difference principle under capitalism is next to impossible. Despite this rosy picture of capitalism as an equalizer of inequality where good people do well, capitalism does actively encourage widening the gap between the best and worst off. This clearly runs counter to the goals of the difference principle. Finally, since we are focused on the well-ordered society that upholds environmental justice, a capitalist framework seems ill-suited for this task. Capitalism encourages over-extraction, overproduction, and the commodification of nature and animals due to its expansionary dynamic, where industries are incentivized to rely on fast, cheap, and unsustainable production methods to generate profit. Because of these three general worries, in my paper, I suggest that a Rawlsian well-ordered society can be achieved under David Schweikart's system, economic democracy. Here, I'll give a really brief sketch of this economic framework. If needed, I can further explain the system during the Q&A, but the main point here is just that environmental justice in the Rawlsian society is best supported by any sort of system that is anti-capitalist. So first, under economic democracy, workplace democracies are encouraged for the sake of worker well-being. Second, investment funds are generated publicly. So workplaces pay taxes to the government for land, buildings, and equipment, making the means of production collective property. These taxes are then distributed on different levels to communities on a per capita basis, satisfying a standard of fairness by diminishing inequalities between regions. And finally, the market under economic democracy, in a similar way to capitalist systems, is unregulated. But Schweikart argues that the existence of an unregulated market does not imply that economic democracy is in some way capitalist. So obviously under any sort of market economy, companies are aiming to maximize the divide between costs and sales. However, under economic democracy, labor is not this cost to be paid out alongside equipment and land. Instead, laborers are these claimants who stand to gain whatever remains after the costs have been paid out. So the previously outlined characteristics of economic democracy have several implications for the well-ordered society's success and structure. Summed up, economic democracy does a better job across the board when it comes to equality, job security, and promoting the balance between increased income and leisure. The well-ordered society welcomes these improvements since they support the principles of justice and several Rawlsian instrumental values. As well, economic democracy mitigates the impact of the political economy on the rest of nature. So then it's clear that part of avoiding the contradiction that's laid out at the start of the paper is this commitment to an anti-capitalist political economy, such as economic democracy. So along with an anti-capitalist political economy, several reforms and innovations on the ecological front will ensure that the Rawlsian well-ordered society does not fall into ecological contradiction. One considerable climate change threat comes from the pollution brought about by human activity. We can take four steps generally to curb the effects of pollution. The first is to stop subsidizing coal and oil. The second is to impose emission limits for heavy polluters. The third is to enforce a carbon tax on fossil fuels. And finally, to support and fund the development of green technologies and green community design. Collectively, these steps would push us towards a more sustainable economy focused on renewable energy and provide the materials needed to fund the eco-friendly shift. Second, reforming our food systems. The solution to reforming our food systems, which have disproportionate ecological effects, may be right in front of us, as illustrated by a really wonderful study of 38,700 farms and 1,600 food producers, packagers, and retailers by Poor and Nemec. Across the board, Poor and Nemec have found that most strikingly, impacts of the lowest impact animal products typically exceed those of vegetable substitutes, providing new evidence for the importance of dietary change. The impact of animal agriculture strains several ecological and human systems. Currently, 47% of habitable ice and desert-free land on the planet is used for agriculture, and most of this land is used for livestock. In total, food production is responsible for a quarter of worldwide greenhouse gases, with animal products accounting for 78% of these emissions. However, these animal products only provide 18% of calories and 37% of the world's protein, an amount that is clearly not proportionate to the ecological damages of these practices. In contrast, plant-based foods' carbon footprints are around 10 to 50 times smaller, an ecological benefit not currently represented by our allocation of land. Our current food consumption habits contribute disproportionately to deforestation, loss of biodiversity, greenhouse emissions, and pollution runoff. So then, redistributing agricultural land to prioritize better food sources could go a long way in curbing the impact of agriculture on our planet. This suggested shift would also help mitigate the scarcity of resources, which is a problem that Rawls is ultimately concerned with. As it stands, 36% of the world's calories are used to feed livestock, whereas only 12% of those calories actually contribute to human diet. So a beef burger then relies on these two sets of resources to grow food and raise cattle. More efficient agricultural practices and growing food for direct human consumption could increase available calories by 70%, feeding an additional 4 billion people. And finally, third, public health. So improper treatment of nature and animals also puts the well-ordered society or any society at risk for global pandemics and injury and illness caused by natural disasters. The World Health Organization notes that since we coexist with the entirety of nature, the interface between humans, animals, and the environment we share can be a source of disease impacting public health and the social and economic well-being of the world population. If the well-ordered society wishes to secure human justice on the front of public health, reforming these practices will play an integral role. So one further hurdle to implementing ecological care is a psychological one. We need to encourage people in a well-ordered society to care for the rest of nature more thoroughly. Indeed, we can strong-arm people into making ecologically sound decisions. Taxes, subsidies, and community design can incentivize people to make sustainable choices that positively impact the rest of nature. However, this sort of strong-arm approach does not ensure that people care about these issues. We can go deeper and aim to educate. Empowering consumers with the knowledge they need about the impact of their choices provides people with deep reasons to enact change. Sharing of knowledge also puts pressure on consumers and producers to enact better practices. Taking this approach within the well-ordered society's framework generates stability by providing strong intrinsic reasons for persons to override temptations and inclinations to act unjustly. So in this way, public education plays a moral education role. It promotes the acceptance and stability of the Rawlsian environmental justice by educating persons at an early stage of their moral development. Here we can see how part of promoting Rawlsian environmental justice will involve a project of motivating persons to internalize the intrinsic value of the rest of nature. There are merely instrumental reasons that persons have for caring about nature. And the most significant reason is to secure human justice. Beyond these reasons, though, promoting the intrinsic value of nature will also be beneficial for the well-ordered society. Fostering persons in the well-ordered society to internalize the intrinsic value of nature will result in a more solidaristic, self-respecting, empathetic, and kind citizenry attuned to the plight of non-human animals and nature. This approach ultimately shows how these issues are not downstream concerns. They are connected to the principles of justice themselves. So an underlying thread has tied all the elements of this paper together. At the start of this paper, I forwarded several instrumental reasons for the Rawlsian to care about the rest of nature. Without this concern, the Rawlsian well-ordered society struggles to be well-ordered at all. However, as I've noted, there is this deeper level in which the Rawlsian project must care about the rest of nature. This care is embedded and connected to the principles of justice. Anyone who takes these principles seriously must acknowledge the importance that respect for the rest of nature has on securing human justice. Reasons for accepting this conclusion exist throughout this paper, and they overlap in meaningful ways with a rejection of capitalism. Ultimately, because unsustainable practices and capitalism are so tied up in each other and lead to widespread inequality, erosion of solidarity, and impact the distribution of primary goods, the Rawlsian project must take on both problems at once. So in this paper, I've argued that a Rawlsian institutional design project that does not fulfill the requirements of environmental justice and animal justice will struggle to create a well-ordered society. In particular, a lack of care for the rest of nature encourages unchecked ecological disaster that impacts the equality of persons, the distribution of burdens, stability, and securing of solidarity. A Rawlsian well-ordered society that hopes to do well by the principles of justice must practice anti-capitalist environmental justice. This presentation has been super condensed and it contains really only the main contours of my argument. However, I have aimed to show how these issues are pressing and both instrumentally and intrinsically Rawlsian. And this is my final slide with my sources, and I'm really looking forward to the Q&A and hearing the rest of the presentations.
Thank you very much, Tira. Well, in fact, you have already a question, but we will wait till the end to put them together. But there are questions. Okay, the next one is Joseph Porter and Adam Gibbons, existential risk and equal political liberty. Please go ahead.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. So we're going to be tag teaming. I'm Joseph and that's Adam. And I think Adam is going to be going through the slides us. And then we'll just go back and forth. But thank you all for being here. We're going to be talking about existential risk and equal political liberty. You can go to the nutshell slide, Adam. And the plan in a nutshell, the argument in a nutshell, is that the parties in the original position have reason to mitigate X risk, to be worried about it. But we're going to suggest that it's doubtful whether democracies always optimally mitigate X risk. And we're not really in a position to know which systems are going to do that. And so our conclusion is that the parties have reason to reject the requirement of equal political liberty in favor of an experimentalist political approach, which doesn't rule out all non-democratic systems, because some of those might better mitigate X risk. This isn't an all things considered point. We can't survey all the different reasons that Rawls gives for requiring equal political liberty. We're just going to suggest that there's strong reason against that requirement. So the next slide, the plan quickly is Adam will summarize some relevant literature on existential risk in three pathologies of democracy, which we think make it harder for democracies to mitigate X risk. He'll talk a little bit about political experimentalism and what that is and why it might be an appealing option to the parties. Then I'll kind of bring that all to bear on the deliberations of the parties in the original position. We'll discuss two objections to our argument and reply to those, and then conclude just talking through some broader implications. you can take it away, Adam. I think it's you next.
All right. Thanks so much, Joseph. All right. So as you just heard, the central claim of our paper is that rational agents in the original position, because they're concerned to mitigate existential risks of various kinds, would drop the requirement of equal political liberty in favor of a more open experimental approach. To understand that claim, we've got to unpack a few things. The first, most obvious component of the argument is existential risk. So what the hell is existential risk, you might be asking. So for what it's worth, in the background literature here, there's no generally agreed upon definition. It doesn't really impact our argument all that much. We're following Toby Ord, who's a recent prominent scholar who contributes to this area. And we define existential risks as follows. They're risks of existential catastrophe, which would destroy humanity's long-term potential. So the background idea here is that if humanity were to persist into the long-term for our future, it could be potentially, in expectation, exceedingly good, right? You're going to have billions and trillions of people all living wonderfully beautiful lives. That's the idea. It's quite utopian, I suppose. But the idea is that a true existential catastrophe would just totally eradicate that possibility. So paradigmatically, we're going to be thinking about things like risks of extinction. So you got your natural extinction risks, like your asteroids, supervolcanoes, naturally occurring pandemics, and so on and so forth. You got various anthropogenic risks. Following a schema from Phil Torres, who's got an interesting textbook on this, you can divide these into two, although don't worry about the details of the taxonomy too much. There are agential terror, sources of agential terror, so things like nuclear war, and engineered pandemics. So think about COVID-19, but worse, or think about captain ships from the stand sort of thing. A global totalitarianism. It's worth noting that an extinction risk, an existential risk doesn't necessarily need to be extinction, right? You could just be in a perpetually miserable state, right? Or think about things like wild sci-fi scenarios like The Matrix. That would also count as an existential catastrophe, following Ord's definition. Interestingly enough, there's also cases of agential error. So think about some worries over super collider experiments going wrong and accidentally creating a black hole, which destroys our life on Earth. Or even more far out scenarios involving things like grey goo, which is a kind of informal name for hypothetical nanotechnology that self-replicates and keeps self-replicating in a way that, again, just utterly obliterates life on Earth. Some of these scenarios seem quite far out, and indeed very many of them are very unlikely to ever occur, but it's worth noting out that there have been actual worries about this in the past. So Nick Bostrom, in a recent paper, discusses an example. Back in the early days of testing nuclear weapons, there was real worry among scientists working in this field that testing a nuclear weapon would ignite the atmosphere, thus setting the planet on fire, so to speak. And people didn't know whether that would happen or not. And needless to say, if that happened, it wouldn't be very good. So there's all sorts of things. And then, of course, there's going to be risks that we're not even aware that we're exacerbating. Those are the sorts of things that we mean when we're talking about existential risk. And we, of course, think that rational agents in the original position would want to mitigate these risks if possible. We want to focus on three features of these sorts of risks for our purposes. First is that many, although not all of them, will take place over long timescales. So most X risks, they're not likely to occur for a very long time. So think about a catastrophic asteroid impact. Asteroids enter our atmosphere all the time. They're mostly very small. I guess they wouldn't be called asteroids then. There's an inverse relationship between the size of an asteroid and how likely it passes by our orbit. A truly world-destroying asteroid doesn't occur very often. So we're not likely to happen. It's not likely to happen for a very long time. Another feature is the low individual probability of these existential risks. So when you think about something like a stellar explosion, there's a chance of something like 1 in 100 million of some, or something like that. Right? Not super likely to happen. Notice though that the cumulative probability of any single existential risk occurring might be worryingly high. Toby Ord, for instance, puts it at 1 in 6 in the next 100 years. So that's exceedingly high, right? It's something we want to fix if we can. And lastly, most of these risks are very complex, and you can't really understand them without grasping a whole bunch of underlying technical issues. So one issue that lots of people worry about nowadays, especially in global priorities research areas, would be value misaligned artificial general intelligence. The idea here is just think about your Terminator scenarios. You create an artificial general intelligence, and it ends up destroying us or enslaving us and so on. You can't really understand the alignment problem without understanding AI and machine learning and various other things, decision theory. And we think that these three features make it as well, maybe not especially difficult. We're not certain that's the whole point of our paper, but we think these features make it difficult for democracies to mitigate these risks. So consider the following pathologies of democratic decision-making. First, we have rational voter ignorance, or just voter ignorance. I'm going to skip some detail here just to save time, but the idea here is just that the costs of acquiring political information for most voters typically exceed the benefits. Acquiring political information is exceedingly costly. It's time intensive, it's cognitively demanding, and it's got a high opportunity cost. And these costs are, of course, exacerbated when it comes to things like existential risks, which are very complex and difficult to understand. Similarly, we can talk about things like voter irrationality. The idea here is that the costs of being consistently rational when reasoning about political matters outweighs the benefits, right? Being rational consistently for protracted periods of time, it's a very cognitively demanding endeavor. And there's all sorts of things we could talk about in the Q&A perhaps related to like political polarization and the benefits of political irrationality. But the idea here is just that in general, for most voters, and indeed for my part, most political agents in general, being well-informed and being rational is not something that we're incentivized to do. And this is a problem that democracies need to grapple with. Most importantly, perhaps, is what's called democratic short-termism. This is not our term. This is something that is already identified in the wider literature. The idea here is that democracies pay attention to problems only in a very short-term scale, short time scale. So there are more general determinants of short-termism that apply to any political arrangement whatsoever. You get various cognitive biases. You have so-called rational discounting. The idea here is just that given uncertainty about the future, the expected value of actions or options available only in the long term for our future are reduced relative to more near-term, more certain options, right? More importantly are various institutional determinants of short-term planning and short-term thinking that come along with being in the sort of democracy that Rawls would have said is a requirement of justice. So you think about various electoral incentives that pressure politicians in particular to pay attention only to short-term problems for which they can provide visible solutions and for which they can improve their proximate reputation, thereby increasing their chances of electoral success, right? The idea here is that it's valuable for a politician, a careerist politician, to pursue public policy goals that will make them look good, right? And this is often counter to things that would be very good for long-term issues and neglected issues such as various existential risks. There's all sorts of other institutional determinants as well, things like being beholden to moneyed interests that have short-term goals as well. But I'm going to skip some of the detail here to save time. The idea is relatively clear. And we think that these pathologies, in addition to others, right, we don't think that these are the only three problems that democracies have. We don't think democracies are the only ones that have these problems. We could also talk about various problems related to corruption and capture, that sort of thing. But we think these pathologies really harm the ability of democracies to properly mitigate complex long-term problems in general, right? So when you look around at what people are focusing on policy-wise and problem-wise, some X risks are ignored almost entirely. Hardly anyone talks about them. It's a very small group of scholars who focus on this sort of thing. Others, while not ignored, are not taken as seriously as they could be. You might think about like a true disaster of a pandemic, right? One wonders if that's even going to change even in the wake of COVID-19. And in general, like, political actors don't think too far ahead into the future, not really planning for risks that may occur only in 1,000 years time or 10,000 years time. They're thinking about what's going to happen in the next 2 to 4 years or at most 10, 20 years, something like that, right? They're not thinking about an asteroid impact 1,000 years hence or a stellar explosion 100,000 years hence, right? But the problem is that they arguably should, right? Especially if they buy into a background Rawlsian picture. So we think it's not likely that a rational agent in the original position would want a requirement of equal political liberty, given the plausible suboptimality of democratic institutions in this domain. We don't think that the pathologies that I've just mentioned entail the suboptimality of democratic X-risk mitigation. That would be a non sequitur. But we think that they do give us at least some reason for doubt, and that's all we need for our argument to go through. So we have an analogy in the paper. It's more clear in the paper, so forgive me if I get some of the details wrong. But you can imagine Forrest, and Forrest is a guy who likes to bet on horse races. And the idea here is just that there's very many different types of horse races and the different types of horses, obviously, different bred for different purposes, different physical characteristics. And you might think when he's placing his bets, he needs to know which sort of horses are best suited for which sorts of races and that sort of thing. And he comes across a stable of horses, and the only horse he sees is a colt with one of its legs in a cast, right? So this horse is obviously going to be suboptimal, or plausibly suboptimal, when it comes to winning races, right? Securing good results. And Forrest doesn't have any other information specifically about very many of the other competing horses, but he knows that they're out there, possibly thousands of them. And he doesn't really have any specific reason to think that they're also similarly injury prone. Do they all have their legs in a cast or not? They all could be worse. They all could have all of their legs in a cast, for example. But some of them might be in good health. And we think, well, it's sort of similar with political institutions. The idea here is this. When you're thinking about political institutions and mitigating existential risk, you're placing bets, right? You're thinking about which will most increase the possibility that we can actually safely navigate these sorts of issues. And there's very many types of political institutions, the vast majority of which we've never even experimented with. The logical space here is vast, and we've only really experimented with a tiny, tiny sliver of this logical space. We don't really have any direct reason to think that this the entirety of logical space is just going to be such that it's filled up with political institutions that are just as bad or worse than democracies, which, as we've seen, is hobbled or injured, like the horse, by the various pathologies that I've just outlined. And so you might think we're in a position where we should really doubt whether democracies are going to be optimal for this sort of purpose, given this range of other competing ones, and given the fact that in the same way that there are different horses that might be good at different horse races, different institutions tend to be better at producing good outcomes when it comes to different contexts, different cultural norms, different times, and so on. So it's not even clear on general systematic grounds that democracy is always the best at everything all the time. So why would we think that it's better than all of these other unexperimented with alternatives when it comes to this neglected risk of existential risk, or a neglected issue, I should say. Almost there now for me. We have a very under-detailed account of political experimentalism to offer here, because it's going to be this is a greatly truncated version of the paper. But the idea is very simple. Rather than requiring equal political liberty, which may optimally mitigate existential risk, but it might not, we think rational agents would permit, at least permit, perhaps even require political experimentation with all sorts of different institutions in order to see which are actually best at managing long-term complex problems in general. And we're happy to be extremely open here. What sorts of systems would we have in mind? Things like epistocracies, which would very obviously be inegalitarian in a certain way. Lotocracies, where political power is allocated by sortition. Hybrid systems, hybrid combinations thereof. Feutarchy, using betting markets to make policy. Hell, even have AI governance, although I think that could actually be an existential risk by itself. We don't know, right? We don't know 100% what's going to work here. But we're doubtful that democracies are always going to work in every single context all of the time. So we think we've got good reason to experiment. So now it's on to Joseph again.
Yeah, so I'm just going to basically apply all of that. If you can get, yeah, thanks, Adam, for that summary. So what do we know about the parties in the original position? Well, we know that Rawls thinks that they have the general facts available to them. And that means that they can know all the general facts that Adam just summarized. And that means that they know, assuming that our presentation is accurate, that it's doubtful whether democracies optimally mitigate X risk. And they have reason to be concerned about this. Rawls thinks that they want to agree upon principles of justice that will work for all generations. They can't just neglect the long term. They want principles of justice that all generations can follow and will want all other generations to follow. And they want to improve life for later generations. Rawls talks about this briefly with the just savings principle. And so we think a fortiori, they're going to be greatly concerned to make sure that every generation does its part to ensure that later generations just aren't wiped out altogether. And Rawls briefly mentions a zeroth principle of justice, lexically prior to the first principle requiring that citizens' basic needs be met. And we think that that gestures to his concern for the protection of both present and future citizens' fundamental freedoms and lives, all of which is threatened by existential risk. Next slide, please, Adam. And I think we're getting up there on time, if I'm not mistaken. So the upshot of all this is that if the parties in the original position are greatly concerned to mitigate X risk, and if they know that it's doubtful whether democracies are going to do that optimally, then they have reason to reject the requirement of EPL, equal political liberty, and to rule in multiple systems as possibly just. We think that they can still guarantee the other equal political, equal liberties. We're not advocating for illiberal systems, freedom of association, freedom of conscience, and so on, still guaranteed, just not the specific requirement of one person, one vote, because that requirement may threaten countless generations' lives and basic needs. I don't know exactly how many minutes we have, so we may just have to stop here. Maybe Adam can fly through the rest of the presentation.
Sure.
And yeah, just skip that stuff.
Yes, yeah, okay. So apologies for running over time. So there are two obvious objections that people might have responding to this. The first is what I'm calling the epistemic democracy objection. The idea here is that someone might just reject the claim that these various pathologies allegedly afflicting democracy actually lead to a compromised decision-making. I'm going to skip lots of details here, but very many people in formal epistemology and political epistemology point to various mathematical theorems, which they think show that democratic collective decision-making can produce sound decisions, even if the groups are constituted by people who are individually ignorant or not as competent as various experts. And, you know, less fancy, you might just think voters have various heuristics that they can draw upon so that the problems of ignorance and irrationality are greatly mitigated. But we think this is somewhat naive. We think the relevant theorems presuppose minimal thresholds of competence, which are very rarely met, if ever, and it's not clear whether actual democracies pass this threshold. And more importantly, the theorems certainly don't entail, unlike what some people might say, they certainly don't entail that no non-democratic group can ever outperform competing democratic groups. It's just a mistake, right? That's not what the theorems show whatsoever. On the heuristics themselves, they're very often unreliable. Most of them don't apply to things like existential risk whatsoever. Determining which heuristics are actually reliable is extremely costly. And this just brings us back to square one where it comes to cost outweighing benefits, that sort of thing. So we think the response from epistemic democracy is not likely to succeed. The second, I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit here just to save some time. The second objection is that, okay, even if actual democracies are not likely to be optimal when it comes to mitigating existential risk, reformed or suitably reformed democracies would be. And various many people working on long-termist political philosophy put forward various proposals. You know, you could have constitutional provisions that require people to try to safeguard the far future of humanity. You can have ombudsmen for future generations, things like youth quotas. The idea here is that younger people might care about the future more, so having more of them in power would be a good thing for these sorts of things. Non-electoral alternatives such as sortition, the idea being to remove the electoral cycle, which removes a source of short-termism, and so on. And although we can't go into all of the details here because I'm probably out of time, here's what we say in the paper. These reforms might do better than the status quo, although again, we're not sure. We really are experimentalists. We really take seriously the idea that we don't know. However, we doubt again whether they'd be optimal for mitigating existential risks. Various of these proposals just simply, they presuppose that democracy would be superior than all available alternatives. They don't actually argue for it. So it's question begging. So that's obviously not a problem for our paper. Most ignore the problems associated with voter ignorance and voter irrationality. They're very Pollyanna-ish views of real political decision-making, right? And more generally, the basic point here is this. The few that we think would actually do a decent job, they don't guarantee optimality, right? You can incentivize long-term decision-making, but that doesn't guarantee optimal long-term decision-making. There could be various alternatives that would do even better, and that's what we think rational agents would want. It's also worth noting that some of these proposals violate equal political liberty in and of themselves. So that's something people should be aware of. And so concluding remarks, I'll pass over to Joseph.
Yeah, and I think the main thing is that this doesn't apply only to Rawls. What we're working from is general facts about ESC risk and political psychology, and then two plausible normative commitments that aren't uniquely Rawlsian. One to the importance of people's lives and basic needs, and one to the non-negligible weight of future generations' interests. And if we can agree on all that, then we have at least some reason to reject the requirement of equal political liberty. Thank you so much, and we'll pass it on now to Giulio.
Thank you very much. Giulio, yes, go ahead.
Thank you. All right. Okay. So thank you for having me, and I really enjoyed the previous talks, and I'll be glad if we can have questions later, because I have some questions in mind. And I'm afraid we'll have to go back from the concrete to the quite abstract, as I'm going to talk about political legitimacy, in fact. So the title was Political Liberalism Necessary After All. It's a rather catchy title that I've chosen, but what I'm going to focus on is, in fact, the problem of political legitimacy and why it's, I think, not addressed well in Rawlsian political liberalism. And I will end up by suggesting very briefly a plausible alternative, which is still inspired by Rawls, but by the Rawls of a theory of justice. So in a way, that hence the title, Why Was Political Liberalism Necessary After All? I would suggest that if the political liberal turn in Rawls is an attempt to solve the problem of political legitimacy, then I'm afraid it's not necessary after all. Maybe there are other reasons to evolve towards the public reason paradigm, but they cannot be reasons of political legitimacy. So I'm going to start by presenting the problem of political legitimacy in what I take it to be its best light. Let's start from a very banal statement. Modern governments operate through law. And one of the features of law that has been recognized in contemporary general jurisprudence is that law by itself inherently always claims authority, right? You can find this kind of insight in John Gardner, in Razi's The Authority of Law, in a paper by Bas van der Vossen, and in many other. And although it's, as usual in philosophy, it's a contested judgment, it's a quite common position in general jurisprudence. So what is a legitimate government? Well, by combining these two judgments, is a government where the law does not only claim, but possess authority. And for authority, of course, we mean moral authority. And what that does mean in practice, it means that the commands given by the state through laws give its citizens genuine and not simply proclaimed moral reasons for action. They don't simply proclaim to say what people ought to do, but they succeed in doing that. They actually succeed in giving people reasons for action. So legitimacy, the legitimacy of the state, what does it consist of? It consists, well, first of an institutional context which serves just to isolate the problem. We're talking about the legitimacy of the state and not the legitimacy of something else. Claimed authority, which is a feature that I said before, attaches to the law inherently, and what David Enoch called robust reason giving, so this capacity to give genuine reasons for action, not simply to proclaim to do so, which entails then that under a legitimate authority, subjects do have an obligation to obey the law in general, right? There might be exceptions of necessity, but in general, because the law is capable of giving genuine reasons for action, then citizens do have an obligation to obey the law. All right, then. That is the problem of political legitimacy, as I see it, to demonstrate that the state is capable of doing that, that within a specific state, the law is capable of giving citizens genuine reasons for actions. Now, here's how Rawls attempts to solve the problem of political legitimacy in political liberalism. He says famously that the state is legitimate if it exercises authority according to a constitution, the essentials of which all citizens as free and equal may reasonably be accepted to endorse. And the phrase may reasonably be expected to endorse, I believe, can be read without remaining faithful to its core meaning, as all citizens, what all citizens may reasonably be expected to endorse may actually be reread as may be endorsed by the reason. So what we mean here essentially is that the constitution, or more precisely the constitutional essentials of a legitimate state, may be endorsed by a consensus of reasonable views and reasonable individuals. So I say it is legitimate, and that is the sort of the core term in political liberalism. State is legitimate when the constitutional essentials are publicly justifiable in the sense that it can be endorsed by the reasonable. How do we get there? Okay, here I'm gonna follow initially not Rawls, but the sort of arch Rawlsian Jonathan Kwong. Are you guys still listening to me? Or okay, because I saw your face freeze a moment and I okay, thank you. Kwong in chapter 4 of Liberalism Without Perfection says that it might make sense that the solution to the problem of political legitimacy involves initially a reference to justice, so that the legitimate state is the one that best promotes justice, in fact. And that is a solution that is consonant to the famous natural duty argument in TOJ, right? In Theory of Justice, when Rawls says we all have a natural duty to help promote or help create, if there aren't already there, just institutions. So the legitimate state in theory would be the state that promotes justice. But because there is reasonable disagreement about justice, or at least not about the whole of the, but there is reasonable disagreement about comprehensive theories of justice, then necessarily a legitimate state cannot be a state that promotes an entire conception of justice. It has to be, as Rawls says, in political liberalism, a state that is justifiable to the reasonable. But now let's not forget the other aspects of the sort of the political liberal term, right? And the other aspect is that Rawls identifies what we may call the proper side of political legitimacy. Now Rawls doesn't use these words, but obviously they are Rawlsian words, right? Rawls talks of a side of justice, not of a side of a legitimacy. But it's pretty clear that the constitutional essentials become, in political liberalism, the proper side of political legitimacy. So the aspect of society that we should be concerned when we assess the legitimacy of the state, right? And why that? Well, first, what are constitutional essentials? What they are fundamental principles that specify the general structure of government, the political process, and equal basic rights and liberties of citizens. So the institutional structure of the state, on the one hand, and the basic rights and liberties of citizens. But why are they, and not the wider basic structure of the society, which is the famously the side of justice, why are those the proper side of political legitimacy? And Ross answers this with a kind of an sort of an empirical note. It says, because basic methods of distributive justice, so the ones that we should, they would need to regulate the basic structure, are nearly always open to wide differences of reasonable opinions, right? So because we will always disagree reasonably. Again, we can reference back to Quandt here. Because we will disagree reasonably about matters of distributive justice or about a whole conception of justice, then we will have to fall back, in a way, to the constitutional essentials when we have to assess the legitimacy of the state, because only constitutional essentials, only on constitutional essentials, only on this sort of very micro aspect of society and in this core of a society, we can expect consensus of the reasonable. Okay, so constitutional essentials are justified when they can be endorsed by the reasonable, and that's what makes a state legitimate. What about concrete laws? So how can we then decide whether concrete laws are justified? Well, essentially they're justified because they are consistent with the constitutional essentials, or because they can be defended for public reason, right? There's as a result of the duty of civility, citizens deliberating in the public forum must give each other public reasons, and public reasons only when defending and trying to implement laws that demand others' compliance. And from there follows the famous example of the Supreme Court of the United States as an exemplar of public reason, right? Because what the Supreme Court does, at least according to Rawls, is exactly that, right? He discusses the constitutionality of laws, so by reference, of course, to their consistency with the constitutional essential, at least interpreted in a certain way, and it only uses public reason. It avoids reference to anything that derives from a comprehensive conception of the good. Now, what it means for public, well, you guys, I assume already know that there are various conceptions on what it means for a reason to be public, and I'm not gonna focus much on that. Now, I believe that in light of what I take as a problem of political legitimacy, there is a general problem with these strategies, which I call the dilemma of reasonable idealization, and which I'm going to be very open about. Is it's nothing particularly novel, so you won't find here a particularly novel critique of Rawlsian political liberalism. In fact, the dilemma in itself is partly inspired by Enoch, but I want to use it then to show the advantages of the alternative. Okay. So I haven't defined the reasonable before, because in a Rawlsian conference, I presume that we know more or less who the reasonable are. But we also know that reasonable is, of course, an idealization. And I think especially when we address the problem of political legitimacy, we have an issue here of what put the idealization. Right? If the reasonable are too idealized to the point that they actually all agree on basic methods of distributive justice, which they shouldn't, because Rawls said that these are always open to reasonable interpretation. But if they are, then there is no, political liberal solution is not responsive any longer to disagreement, right? And that's pretty clear. Public justification becomes completely redundant. But suppose the reasonable are not idealized much, and I would say they're not idealized up to that level, then it seems to me that there is no solution at all to the problem of political legitimacy, as at least as I presented it at the beginning. And public justification then just becomes simply normatively inane. Why? And this is the reason. Because suppose that I'm subject to a particular law that demands my compliance, right? And that presumes to give me reasons for action, like all laws do. Now, if I follow the whole political liberal strategy about the justification of a specific law that I presented before, what I ought to do in the end, as a reasonable citizen, is see that the law that has been justified by reference to its compatibility with constitutional essential and by being presented for public reason as ultimately accessible to me, as well, reasonable, as compatible with constitutional principles that I agree are overall justified. But still, that doesn't mean that it gives me any reasons for action. It doesn't mean that the state has succeeded in giving me reasons robustly. And that's, and the reason why can be expressed through this slogan. And it's that just because you did me the courtesy of justifying a norm in a way that I can understand or can see as reasonable, and we can replace here these formulas with all the various versions of public reason, it does not follow that I should accept you have the authority to impose the norm on me. There's still a normative passage that is missing there, right? Which is where we establish that you have really given me reasons for action. What we have established simply is that you're not trying to impose on me a norm that is completely crazy for me, that is not beyond the realm of reasonable acceptability. But that doesn't mean that I ought to comply, right? Especially if I'm reasonable. Because if I'm reasonable, I can always reply, well, look, you're trying to impose on me a reasonable norm, but I'm also a reasonable person, so I will do something different, which is also reasonable. And why should I follow your norm instead of keeping to doing what I was already doing, which is also reasonable? So there's this crucial passage which is missing, which is the one where we establish that the authority is capable of giving me reasons for action. Now, a 20-second break, because I need to lower the curtains because I'm getting blind, sorry. Sorry, because the sun has risen and I was getting blind, sorry. okay. So I suggest that we change paradigm. And I start by saying that we should change the site of legitimacy, that we shouldn't see the site of legitimacy as reducible any longer to constitutional essentials. So where I suggest that we should put the site of legitimacy instead, I suggest the basic structure. Why? Well, for very Rawlsian reasons. Rawls says that the basic structure is there to secure just background conditions against which the action of individuals and associations take place. He introduces this famous division of labor between individual norms of conduct and the basic structure on the other, so that individuals and associations are left free to advance their ends more effectively, securing the knowledge that elsewhere in the social system the necessary correction to preserve better justice are being made. And finally, in Social Unity and Primary Good, he says that only within the background conditions of the basic structure can citizens fully accept responsibility for their ends and take charge of their lives by adapting their conception of the goods to their expected fair share of primary goods. So I suggest starting from the Rawlsian use of the basic structure that we see legitimacy instead of something different, not as a function of what reasonable citizens may endorse, but as a function of what we may call normative impact. And I suggest that an authority is legitimate if the normative conditions that it produces through the basic structure help citizens in two fundamental aspirations that they have. One is to act justly towards one another, and the other to take responsibility to their ends, so to develop as an autonomous agent, to act autonomously. And this legitimacy as normative impact approach, I think, ties neatly with an intuitive idea that authorities are legitimate when they act for their subjects. I put citizens there, but I should have put subject because it's general. It applies to authorities in general. The authority of parents too is justified, is legitimate when parents are shown when the authority of parents is shown to have a beneficial impact on children. And this intuitive ground is, I think, captured well by the legitimacy as normative impact. So very, very briefly, there's a possible objection here lurking in the background, which is, what about disagreement? My solution is clearly not responsive to disagreement at all. And that can be true, but I have two responses. One is that, as I showed before, political liberalism doesn't seem to fare any better because of what I call the dilemma reasonable idealization. And secondly, if we do really care about this agreement, why not going for pure democratic proceduralism about political legitimacy? Or maybe we can have a kind of a more hybrid solution when we combine the legitimacy as normative impact with a form of democratic proceduralism. And we can do that because the democratic structure of a state is, in fact, part of a just basic structure. So we can say, well, legitimacy depends on both on the normative impact in the way I presented it and on the democratic structure of the state, and maybe on something else. So what I've shown so far is merely a kind of a necessary condition for legitimacy and nothing more. But I would be already super content with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Giulio. Okay. Well, now it's time for the discussion. Okay, first of all, we have here a question, an open question in the Q&A to Tira, and there is another one. I will read both of them so that she can answer the questions. Tira, you said, this is Claudio Classe. Tira, you said that the implementation of the difference principle is next to impossible in a capitalist economy because capitalism widens the gap between the top and the bottom. And that goes against the difference principle. But why is so? The difference principle allows for inequalities as long as they go in favor of the least advantaged. That's the first question. And then the second one, it's Joseph Porter's question. Do you think Rawls should incorporate environmental concerns into his theory more for the sake of human beings Or do you think we can incorporate animals and the environment as agents directly worthy of concern into the original position itself? These are all the questions we have so far.
Awesome. Okay, so I'll start by answering the first one. So I was actually hoping to talk about this, so thank you for this question. So first of all, I'll direct you to the text. So in the first edition of The Theory of Justice, look to pages 265 to 284. So here are some of the things that Rawls mentions. First of all, he thinks that we need a political economy that satisfies the difference principle. He thinks that a market economy would be preferable. Third, he mentions that property-owning democracy looks like a pretty nice option. He thinks that taxation that satisfies the requirements of justice would help support justice's fairness. And he thinks that we need democratic working conditions. So all of these things point towards some sort of property-owning democracy or liberal market socialist system. So economic democracy is a good fit given those three pillars that I discussed during the presentation. Capitalism, on the other hand, it struggles to satisfy the taxation requirement and the democratic working conditions. And as you mentioned, the difference principle, it does allow for inequalities. This is really true. However, I can't imagine or point to an existing capitalist society where the best and worst off are leveling up in a proportionate way. There can be inequalities under the difference principle, but the best and worst off can't do this. They need to do this. And under a capitalist system, the widening there is encouraged, and it's not just inequality that levels up together. I also want to mention an email exchange that I had with David Schweikart, the creator of Economic Democracy, where he talked about this letter exchange he had with Rawls. So he said that one of the first papers he published was entitled, Should Rawls Be a Socialist? And at the time, he actually sent a copy to Rawls when Rawls was still alive by mail with a one sentence message, which was, am I right? And he was really excited that Rawls actually responded and sent him a letter back and said, you are right. And apparently at the time, Rawls said that everyone assumed that he was defending some sort of like welfare state capitalism. But he mentions that in his work, he never says that capitalism is the right system. Instead, he is pointing towards things like property-owning democracy. So when I emailed David Schweikart to tell him about this paper and say that I really enjoyed his book, he was like so excited and sent back this thing and was like, you're right. Like, I actually talked to Rawls about this. So I thought that was really cool. So I hope that answers the first question. For the second one, this is also like a really awesome question. And it's something I've spent a lot of time going back and forth on and struggling with. This is still like a fairly early draft of this paper. So it's something I have to decide on soon, which is gonna be really hard. So I think that the inclusion of non-human animals and nature into the original position would be ideal. And by ideal, I mean the best for securing justice on those fronts and for securing human justice. If we can include the rest of nature on its own terms, then there'll be these like weightier reasons to ensure that we actually secure justice on those fronts as well as secure human justice. And we avoid situations where those concerns are brushed aside or overruled by human justice. At the same time though, we could just include those things as products of like things that help support human justice. So the nice thing about this problem is that we can include the rest of nature on its own terms or for the sake of human beings. And either way, we can work to secure justice on both fronts. And I think it's ultimately going to come down to us deciding what reasons we think will be more convincing and easier to implement, instrumental or intrinsic ones. So I hope this like partially answers your question. I think in short, I'm just saying that we can do either, but the two answers present very different reasons to secure justice.
Thank you very much. There are no Q&A right now. There is one which has been answered. If you don't have questions for yourselves, for each other, I will ask a question to Joseph and Adam. Maybe you have said something about it, but I am worried about political experimentalism, because can it be at the same time a source of instability? I mean, if we start like playing with different models of political systems, can it be at the same time a risk?
So you want to go first, Adam?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the norms are here. So I'll give my opinion, which may be slightly different to Joseph's. So yeah, I would just see that under certain conditions, experimenting with institutions would be a risk. But risk is unavoidable. So the problem is to minimize the risk if that's possible. And there's just going to be trade-offs all over the place. And we don't really know a priori in advance how we're going to strike the right trade-offs. You know, if we could rewind the clock, go back a couple hundred years and maybe experiment in safer ways, things would be a little bit better, but it's going to be kind of tricky to implement these things right now. So, I mean, in our paper, we're not as much saying that this is something we need to do right now, because we might think that, but it would be tricky and risky, as you say. But we do think if you're a rational agent in the original position and you're trying to set things up, you would not constrain yourself so narrowly, given the wide variety of problems we face, and most especially these huge, catastrophic, completely comprehensive problems such as existential risk. There's risks associated with experimenting unwisely and too widely and so on, but there's also risks with not experimenting enough and centralizing power too much and creating fragile institutions wherein if you have one error and it just spreads through the whole system, you're not going to be able to do anything. So that's what I think. I'm sure Joseph shares many of my concerns.
Well, and I can add from the perspective of Rawlsian theory, because I actually touch on this in one of the slides that we just skipped for the sake of time. It's a great question. So, and this actually touches some on what Tira was just talking about with the which economic system. So what Rawls says about choosing an economic system is that which of these systems most fully answers to the requirements of justice cannot be determined in advance. And he says there's presumably no general answer to this question. So there are some economic systems that he rules out and says that's just not going to be just no matter what. But he doesn't say you have to pick this one, at least not explicitly. And so he says, no, there it could be one, you know, there are a couple different options. It might be a hybrid. And I think what we want to say is something similar from within Rawls's theory. I think the way to think about experimentalism is applying that kind of idea to political systems and saying, yeah, there's no reason to think that democracy is uniquely going to most fully answer to the requirements of justice. Obviously, we're setting aside Rawls's non-instrumental arguments for democracy, things like self-respect and so on. But just focusing on instrumental concerns for the time being, I think Rawls should say something similar about political systems as he does about economic systems, which is we're not 100% sure which one is going to be best. It's not clear that which one is best for the United States is going to be best for Spain or Mexico or wherever. So political justice should be more permissive. It shouldn't, from the get-go, rule out all non-democratic political systems as just. So there's still some questions that definitely have to be filled in. And Adam and I hope to fill those questions in later work as far as what the range of experimentalism is, how to minimize the risks involved with experimentalism. But hopefully that fills in the picture a little bit more. It's a great question.
Thank you very much. Okay, Giulio, go ahead, please.
Yeah, if I may, I also have a question for Joseph and Adam. So two things here. Well, first, you know, I don't know if you guys yesterday were present at that Veronique Munoz-Dardet's presentation, but she offered a critique to the idea that the original position is a rational choice device, whereas you guys seem to buy that interpretation of the original position, right? As a pure rational choice device. So I wonder if you just agree with that, or what do you think of alternative ways of seeing the original position? Secondly, I'm not I'm not sure I see a problem with existential risk as such, in the sense that what you guys showed in the sort of second part of the presentation is that democracies are run into problems, and run into problems that presumably prevent democracies from taking the best decisions in some cases, right? It can be existential risk, it can be COVID, it can be whatever else. So it seemed to me that if we see the original position as a rational choice device, and if the parties in the original position are provided with information about the malfunctionings of democracies, then you guys have just offered the parties in the original position a reason not to prioritize democracies over alternative institutional forms that respect other liberal values. I'm not sure that existential risk adds much to that, right? We already know that democracies are imperfect because of short-termism, because of the other problems that you presented there. We don't have to add a catastrophe, right, to see why they are imperfect. What do you guys think?
So can I? I wasn't able to be at the presentation yesterday, but so when we're saying what alternative was being suggested, or so what do we mean by saying, oh, this is a rational choice interpretation of the original position, and then and what alternative?
Rawls himself in Justice's Fairness or Restatement, right, says that he was mistaken in presenting in a theory of justice the original position as a rational choice mechanism. And Veronique yesterday was suggesting that the interpretation that Rawls arrives at or that seemed to suggest in the later works is that the original position is no other than a form of Scalonian contractualism, more or less, so that it's a heuristic, it's a pure heuristic that you can use in your head.
Representation. Yeah, I don't think I'll jump in here first, Adam, and then I don't think our paper, and we talk about this briefly, commits us to any particularly controversial reading of the original position, and it doesn't even depend necessarily in any narrow way on what Rawls says about the original position, as much as it depends on just two normative commitments of Rawls's, which I take to be fundamental for him. He's worried about future generations, not just present generations, and that's not an especially controversial, even with what Tyr was saying about environmental justice and climate change. Most people are worried about future generations, and he's giving us, a hierarchy of different kinds of interests that we're worried about. And it's only a footnote in JF, the Justice's Fairness, the discussion about the zeroth principle. He says very little about it, but it's a very intuitive idea that we have to make sure that citizens' fundamental needs, their basic needs, are being secured. And that ties into what Rawls says, about the relationship between the two principles and favorable conditions and the general conception of justice, which may apply under less favorable conditions. And I think I can speak for Adam too in saying that we think that this kind of the worry that we're bringing isn't unique to existential risk. It does generalize. It's not as though we think democracies are rational about everything except existential risk, but there are two features of the problem of existential risk that are especially salient for Rawls. One is that you're dealing with problems that affect all generations. So the existential risk is a problem that doesn't just affect current generations, but ties into what Rawls says about intergenerational justice, which he doesn't say a ton, but he does say enough. And existential risk is something that's going to impact the zeroth principle, our most basic need. So we're not just saying that there's the economy would do better if we had an epistocracy, because then that's, Rawls is going to say, that's not a good enough reason to sacrifice the political liberties. So you need to point to a really fundamental, a really serious problems. And then you can say, yeah, we're not just talking about the economy. We're not just talking about second principle of justice stuff. We're talking about stuff that by Rawls's own lights can actually take priority over the guarantee of the equal basic liberties.
Thank you very much. Well, we have 4 minutes. 4 minutes. Let's see. No question. Well, I have one for Julio, but very short, very short. Maybe also at the same time for Tira, but I don't know. Well, the question is, do you remember in political liberalism, Rawls says, well, he's discussing the differences between civic humanism and classic republicanism. And he says, well, classical republicans in a democratic principle, they match with the well-ordered society. Whereas the civic humanism, well, Aristotelian and so on, they do not. Okay, here is my question. The contestability. Would you agree with the Republican interpretation of Rawls that sees the political legitimacy in a way that the citizens can contest the laws? For example, by means of democratic procedures, revision, exercising political rights or political duty, and this ancient republican virtue of participation. What do you think about that? And Tira, at the same time, your redescription of Rawls can allow this republican pathos? Sorry, I 2 minutes, but that's my question.
Well, I'm afraid I will hardly answer in 1 minute on that. So I'm afraid the only thing I'm gonna reiterate here is that, you know, what I provided through the normative impact account is merely probably a necessary condition for legitimacy.
Okay.
Right. Which allows for a form of political perfection, I think. Right. But then I also think that that's probably not enough for political legitimacy. And that because of that, we'll have to incorporate into a definition of legitimacy some standards that refer not so much on what the state does, but on what citizens want, essentially. So that's where we may reintroduce within an account of legitimacy some procedural aspects. And I only mentioned democratic aspects, but of course, I'm also happy to consider more deliberative matters.
Thank you. Tira, I don't know, you have 1 minute.
I'll say that I've had my head completely in theory of justice for months now, so I'm probably not the best suited position to answer this question. But I will say that, of course, like when it comes to matters of environmental justice, it is helpful to have these procedures where the citizens can actually talk about like if their needs are being met, their worries when it comes to climate crisis. This is something that we already see now, like around like environmental organizing, that people do use these democratic processes and sometimes external processes as well to get things done. So I think, yeah, I think that would fit into the account that I'm trying to draw up.
Thank you very much. Well, the host says that we have 5 minutes. I don't know if you want to ask like the last question. Is there a last question here? Maybe Tira has a last question, or Adam, or Julio, or Joseph. We have 5 minutes, an extra time for us. Well, we can use it or not.
I have a very quick question. I'm not sure if Tira talked about this in her talk, but just a quick clarificatory question regarding Schweikart's market socialist view. What exactly happens to the price system in this? Does it have a well-functioning price system where prices respond properly to supply and demand and so on? Or are the prices set?
That is because it's like a market system, it is like price and demand. But the one thing, I wish I had read this like right before the talk, but he has a specific regulatory function where he tries to ensure that really cheap products aren't being sourced from outside states. He tries to avoid this kind of like temptation we have to, for example, like outsource all of our clothing needs to a different country, specifically because we can pay people way less. So he has a taxation scheme that ensures that that sort of thing doesn't happen. But other than that, like that safety guard, it is a demand-based market.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would need to go read this. I'm not really familiar with the view.
You should read it. The book is called After Capitalism, and it's really awesome, and it's so Rawlsian. I mean, the second you start reading it, you're like, this guy has definitely read Rawls before, and it's really fun for that reason. It's a super interesting book. He's like a philosopher and a mathematician, and it's just, the book is amazing. It also reads in a very like narrative way. So it's a fun read, which you normally don't get to say about things in this topic. So I'd highly recommend it.
Well, I'll definitely take a look at some point. My dirty little secret is that I'm not really a Rawlsian, so I'm not sure if the Rawlsian quality.
I don't think I am either. Yeah, I think it's more just like, you're just kind of like, ooh, this is interesting. But it's a fun read.
Yeah, my main worry in asking the question, which it seems like if it's a more or less well-functioning price system, it might not be a legitimate worry. But one problem that traditional market socialist views run into famously would be problems regarding economic calculation. Mm-hmm. So when you remove a well-functioning price system, you get all sorts of problems with scarce goods, and that's why you inevitably run into shortages and that sort of thing. And I thought that this might count against the proposal slightly, because one of your worries was against, well, it was set in the background of like scarcity of resources and climate change and whatnot. But then if you don't have the right economic system, you might exacerbate those problems. But it seems like his proposal either doesn't have that problem or he's aware of it. I would be interested to think through the overall consequences of the seemingly protectionist overtones, right? If you want to prevent people from outsourcing trade and so on. But yeah, it could work. I'm not sure. I need to go read it, but I was just interested.
Yeah, it's a pretty surprisingly dense book, where every time that I think of an objection and write it down and be like, I've got him now, then like five pages later, he would just completely knock down my objection. So it is frustrating in that way. But I think what you've said is like a very fair charge against like most market socialist systems.
Tira, please, could you write down in the chat the title and the author?
Yes. Let me set to everyone.
Like to panelists or to...
Yeah, I'll do to
panelists everyone. And attendees if it's possible. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. We are very pleased to have had you here with us. And thank you for your presentations. And okay, good luck with your research and goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting. It was really nice to hear everyone's talks as well.
Yes.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you.